and this is VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from John Russell, Anna Mateo, and Brian Lynn. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will present America's Presidents. But first, here is John Russell.
In the 1950s, University of California professor Harold Biswell experimented with controlled burns in the state's forests. At the time, many people thought he was insane to do so. Now, however, Biswell is seen not as insane, but as someone whose research could ease wildfire dangers and save the forests of the American West. Large areas of forest have become overgrown in the American West. These lands have had wildfires that have damaged towns, forced large evacuations, and covered the West Coast in thick smoke. Today, officials want to greatly increase prescribed fires, fires set on purpose and under carefully controlled conditions. Prescribed fires help clear surface fuels in forests. Last month, four U.S. senators proposed legislation called the National Prescribed Fire Act of 2021. It calls for federal officials to substantially increase the number and size of prescribed fires on federal lands. One of the bill's supporters, Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon, said the legislation would double the budget for controlled burns. It took years for forest managers to come around to accept prescribed burning. In the first half of the 20th century, fire was seen as the enemy. Federal and state forest managers believed prescribed burning damaged the environment, especially timber, wood manufactured to build things. But in the late 1960s and 1970s, federal forest managers began using prescribed burns. Yet the increase in prescribed burns has been slow. From 1995 through 2000, an average of 566,560 hectares were treated with prescribed fire each year. That amount is far short of the 28 million hectares that in 2001 were in great need of fuel reduction to avoid serious wildfires, scientist David Carl wrote in his 2002 book, Burning Questions, America's Fight with Nature's Fire. The latest prescribed burning plans face several problems. The periods between wildfire seasons when prescribed burning can happen safely are shrinking. Some forests are too overgrown to burn without thinning, and prescribed fires can fill nearby towns in smoke. Tim Holschbach is Deputy Chief of Policy and Planning with Oregon's Department of Forestry. We have to be mindful of not pouring smoke into communities because that's a violation of the Clean Air Act, Holschbach said. Prescribed burning has prevented disasters. In 2017, a wildfire threatened the town of Sisters, Oregon. But firefighters were able to control it because, months earlier, workers had removed trees and brush and then carried out prescribed burns. The fire came to a halt, both because it had less fuels and also because in the thinned, more natural forest, there was a lot more space for the firefighters, said Senator Jeff Merkley of Oregon. He leads the Senate Interior, Environment, and Related Agencies Appropriations Subcommittee. However, sometimes prescribed burns become uncontrollable. One of the most destructive burns happened in 2012. The Colorado State Forest Service did a 20-hectare prescribed burn near the small town of Conifer, southwest of Denver. The fire appeared to go out as expected, but high winds brought it back to life. Several people died in the fire, which burned 15.5 square kilometers and destroyed over 20 homes. I'm John Russell.
In Serbia, a Roma singing group is using music to spread the message of women's empowerment in their community. The all-female group aims to urge people to resist centuries-old traditions, including male-only leadership. The band formed in 2014 and goes by the name Pretty Loud. They sing about women chained to abuse that has continued through many generations. The group sings about teenage girls whose fathers force them into marriage. The songs urge women to seek love, fight back, and stand up for their right to be treated as equals to men. The band performed last year in the British capital, London, at the Women of the Year Festival. The group spoke to the Associated Press recently about its music and mission. We want to stop the early marriages. We want the girls themselves, and not their parents, to decide whether they want to marry or not, said 24-year-old member Sylvia Sinani. We want every woman to have the right to be heard, to have her dreams, and to be able to fulfill them. To be equal, she added. Sinani said the idea to form a girl band was born at education and artistic classes run for Roma, or Gypsies, by a private organization called Gypsy Roma Urban Balkan Beats, or GRUB for short. At first, she explained, the women danced in GRUB's boys band and then decided they wanted one of their own. They named us Pretty Loud because they knew that women in Roma tradition are not really loud, she said. The band's music is a mix of rap music and traditional Roma music. It targets a younger generation of girls who are yet to make their life choices. The band includes two 14-year-old sisters. Their songs speak to the position of women in the Roma community. Pretty Loud hopes the musical messages will help to increase self-awareness among Roma females. That could be critical in a community where early marriage is widespread. A UNICEF study published last year showed that over one-third of girls aged 15 to 19 in Roma communities in Serbia are already married. And 16% of that group were married before age 15. Serbian officials have formed a government group to work toward ending the practice of early marriage. Pretty Loud member Zlata Ristic said she is an example of early marriage. She is 27 years old and gave birth to a baby boy at age 16. She said, "Nobody forced me into it, but I have realized I should not have done it." Her marriage ended, but Ristic said she wants other women in similar situations to know that their lives are not over once they have children. "My biggest reward is when 14-year-old girls write to me and say they want to become one of us, that they now attend school thanks to us, that they have improved their grades," she said. The Roma people are among the most underserved ethnic communities in Serbia and Europe. Roma mostly settle together, creating communities separate from the society that surrounds them. The people face poverty, joblessness, and discrimination. Activists have warned that the COVID-19 crisis has increased the social isolation of minority groups and made them poorer. COVID-linked restrictions on schools have made it even harder for Roma children to stay in the educational system. I'm Anna Mateo.
U.S. Space Agency researchers successfully used balloons to detect earthquakes in the California desert. The experiment tested whether similar balloons could be sent to Venus to study that planet's seismic activity. NASA recently announced plans to launch two future missions to Venus. The NASA scientists got the chance to carry out the test in July 2019, when a series of powerful earthquakes struck the area around Ridgecrest, California. The main earthquake took place on July 4th and had a magnitude of 6.4, the United States Geological Survey reported in May. Several other large quakes hit the area within days, and more than 10,000 aftershocks were reported over the next 6 weeks. The experiment involved four large sun-powered balloons designed to fly at altitudes of 18 to 24 kilometers. The team attached instruments to the balloons that measure changes in air pressure. The equipment is used to detect sound waves that rise up from beneath the surface during earthquakes and aftershocks. The researchers say that by studying seismic wave activity of a rocky planet like Earth, they can learn more about how that planet developed and about its current state. Venus is also a rocky planet. It is our closest neighbor in the solar system and the second closest planet to the Sun. It is similar in structure to Earth, but a little smaller. But unlike Earth, Venus has an extremely hot surface temperature and a very dense atmosphere. Such conditions make it difficult for spacecraft to survive in Venus's atmosphere or on its surface. Scientists have long thought about the possibility of studying seismic activity on Venus. They want to learn more about how the planet developed such extreme conditions. The researchers from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory think they can send balloons like the ones tested in California on a mission to Venus. The experiment, which also involved scientists from the California Institute of Technology, was recently described in a study in Geophysical Research Letters. Scientists from JPL and Caltech have been developing their balloon-based method since 2016. But the heavy earthquake activity in the California desert in July 2019 gave them a good chance to test their equipment in the field. Seismic energy from earthquakes is transmitted into the atmosphere and produces sound waves. These waves are detected by ground-based seismic stations. But the JPL team reported it was able to detect, for the first time, earthquake-related seismic activity from its balloons. One of the balloons detected seismic sound waves seconds after a 4.2 magnitude aftershock was confirmed by ground-based detection stations. At the time, the balloon was about 4.8 kilometers above the Earth. The researchers hope the balloons will permit new studies of seismic activity on Venus to provide information about the planet's interior. For example, they say this method could help them learn why the surface of Venus stays hot enough to melt lead. It may also lead to discoveries of liquid, such as water or oil, on the planet. Jennifer M. Jackson is a professor of mineral physics at Caltech's Seismological Laboratory who helped lead the research. She said in a statement that much of our understanding about Earth's interior comes from the study of seismic activity happening deep inside the planet. The method could also be possible with Venus. Observations of seismic activity would strengthen our understanding of rocky planets. But Venus's extreme environment requires us to investigate novel detection techniques. The researchers say they plan to continue flying balloons over seismically active areas to improve their ability to identify seismic events over wide areas from the air. They also plan to add more instruments and fly more balloons at the same time. This could permit them to identify where earthquakes happen without the need for confirmation from ground stations. I'm Brian Lynn.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Benjamin Harrison. His family name may sound familiar. That is because he was the grandson of President William Henry Harrison. That situation is unique in U.S. history so far. Harrison played an unusually active role as president at a time when most chief executives saw themselves as simply administrators. As a result, American writer and intellectual Henry Adams said, "Harrison was the best president since Lincoln." But most Americans remember little about him, except his connection to the previous President Harrison, who himself died after only a month in office. Benjamin Harrison grew up on a farm in the Midwestern state of Ohio as one of eight children. His grandfather was not the only famous political Harrison. His great-grandfather signed the Declaration of Independence, and his father had been a congressman. Young Benjamin Harrison respected these men and believed he had a role to play in history, too. He received a good education, and even outside of school, he read many books. His hard work and intelligence carried him to Miami University in Ohio, and then to a career as a lawyer. Along the way, he married a woman he had known since he was a teenager, Carolyn Lavinia Scott. The couple settled in another Midwestern city, Indianapolis, Indiana, and had a son and daughter. Over time, Harrison steadily built a career as a public official. But his political path was interrupted by the American Civil War. Harrison rose to the rank of general in the Union Army. He fought under General William T. Sherman and was one of the first soldiers to enter Atlanta, Georgia, after the city surrendered. Reports say that Harrison was an excellent soldier, but he did not enjoy fighting or find war romantic. After the war, he returned home to Indiana and continued his legal and political career. In 1881, he was elected to the U.S. Senate. But 6 years later, he lost his seat when Democrats came to power in his state. Harrison's loss of his Senate seat soon turned to a victory. The Republican Party nominated him as their candidate to run against Grover Cleveland in the 1888 presidential election. Cleveland's economic policies had become unpopular, and Republicans worked hard to support their candidate. They succeeded. Although Cleveland won the popular vote, Harrison won the Electoral College. In 1889, he followed his grandfather's footsteps all the way to the White House. Harrison's election was a major victory for his Republican Party. In addition to winning the White House, Republicans gained seats in the House of Representatives, held a majority in the Senate, and appointed several Republican justices to the Supreme Court. Harrison and other Republican lawmakers used their power to take action on issues at home and internationally. One act was to preserve forests. Harrison identified 17 protected natural areas and helped create Yosemite National Park in California. His government also established Ellis Island in New York to make immigration to the U.S. a more orderly process. Internationally, Harrison's administration sought to build ties with Latin American countries. His government established what would, in time, become the Organization of American States. His administration also increased the United States' global trade, as well as the country's navy. But, for the most part, the most pressing issues of the day were economic. The federal government at that time had an unusually large surplus. Some argued that the surplus was hurting business. In answer, Harrison's government placed a high protective tariff on imported goods. The legislation was known as the McKinley Tariff of 1890. Officials also aimed to limit the power of large corporations to control important markets in the U.S. Finally, they agreed to require the government to buy silver to use as currency. These actions pleased some of his supporters, but they may have contributed to the severe economic depression that followed Harrison's term. And in general, voters disapproved of the amount of money Republican lawmakers were spending. Although the country was at peace, the 51st Congress appropriated $1 billion. At the midterm elections, many lawmakers paid for all the spending with their seats. 2 years later, voters turned Harrison out of the White House, too. They returned Grover Cleveland to the presidency. Harrison did not express much disappointment. He had worked hard to become president like his grandfather, but he found he did not like being the chief executive. He said, when he left the White House, it was like being released from prison. Among U.S. presidents, Harrison does not have one of the most dramatic biographies. The facts of his life show an intelligent, disciplined man who tried to live by his beliefs. But he was not considered passionate about many things, except perhaps his enjoyment of nature. And he did not have an easy way with people. Even his staff called him the human iceberg, because he could be aloof and act coldly toward people. Yet Harrison's family brought some warmth to his administration. His wife, Carolyn, was known to be a lively, social person. She was the first to install a Christmas tree in the White House. Some of Harrison's grandchildren also lived in the White House. Harrison permitted them to play on the grounds with their pet animals. During Harrison's term, the family kept a goat, which the children called Old Whiskers. Harrison's time in the White House saw sorrow, too. Toward the end of her husband's term, the First Lady became seriously ill with tuberculosis. For months, Benjamin Harrison divided his attention between his wife and his job, and yet in the end lost both. After his term as president ended, Harrison returned to his home in Indianapolis. He did some work as a teacher and lawyer and kept a good public image in his community. He also remarried. His second wife was a widow herself, as well as his first wife's niece. He and Mary Scott Lord Dimmick Harrison had a daughter together. The child was only 4 when Harrison died from pneumonia at age 67. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.